Welcome back to the Beit Midrash. We're continuing the study of Masechet Ta'anit, and I want to dedicate this shiur to Refuah Shleima Shel David Ben Pesi, and that he should have Refuah Shleima and has Tinoket Shel
Tinoket Yael the Abraham.
So Refuah Shleima to a few in the community, and also Nachama. Tonight there's a shiva going on by the Shmutters, so we'll say Le'alui Nishmato Shel Aharon Ben Benyamin V'chaike. I just lost Aaron Shmutter in the community. It was a real Baal Chesed, real mensch of a soul, who taught his sons, according to their eulogies, just how to be fathers. And they savored and talked about the sweet times of the walks to synagogue with their father at the funeral. So good. So, sons, fathers, students, rebbes. Last time we asked on 5b2, we saw the request of Rabbi Nachman to Rabbi Yitzchak to bless him. We read that blessing. Talked about, may the offspring be like you. We turned to 6b2. I'm just doing a little chazara here before we get to what we're going to work on. And we looked at, rain was compared to a wedding day, because I wanted to just make mention of the fact that there was this sense that marriage, as a metaphor between rain and the earth, was really alive and well, and that it had everything from the beauty of a wedding and the aesthetic quality to the kind of overtones of cohabitation and sanctifying the wedding, husband and bride entering the love act. This kind of love between heaven and earth represented then in rain. And then we saw in 6b3 the text of the blessing over rain, which doubled down on the rabbinic culture of blessings. And again, I've been pointing out the rabbi's interest in affirming their own culture, and their own culture has at its core prayer, it has at its core blessings, it has at its core the recognition of the one true God of Israel, who is the power behind all of creation, and there's not dualities in the world, and there are not multiple sources of power in the world. And a lot of the language that we're going to see today that affirms rabbinic culture, again, makes use of some of the conceptions of what God's powers really are, which will come, again, back, as I've talked about the curriculum, kind of spiraling back in on itself. You'll see, we'll start with a passage about the resurrection of the dead, because that was one of the keys that God had, right? And that was one of the powers. And then we'll talk a lot about the day that rain comes, and what's it compared to, and what's it greater than. And, of course, they're teaching you all of what's wonderful and great in their own culture by saying the day of rain is greater than X is greater than Y, but Y still is great, right? So the rain is greater than this day, but that's still really amazing, right? And so we're going to point out to you what's really amazing in our eyes, and then we're going to talk a little bit about that part of rabbinic culture that you may not get the rain unless you behave properly, which harkens back to the original Devarim source of the Hayam Shemoa Tishmu. If you listen to my voice, you get the rains in their seasons. If not, be warned. Right? And that's kind of where we're going to see. There's a run-through of not only what was great, day of rain is greater than this, but if day of rain doesn't come, woe is you for not having fulfilled this. And so we're going to get some of that explication, albeit through oftentimes a celebration of rabbinic culture that's bookending this, the blessing over rain that we learned the liturgy for the last time we were learning, and what will become, again, notes throughout the pages of sages who study Torah, you know, in essence, help make the rain fall. And Torah culture affirms a fertile Torah culture is like good rains on the Jewish people. Okay? So that's where we're going to, that's what we're going to see, all of that. So, start with me on 7a1. We're on Daf Zion tonight. We'll start. and we already had the first couple of words on that. Nimarin hu l'tarvayhu el ha'hodot v'rov ha'hodayot. We had these two last words of the blessing over rain on the beginning of 7a. That was part of the liturgy we saw last week from the blessing over rain. And now another teaching comes, and it's Amar Rabbi Abahu. Abahu says the following. Gadol yom ha'gishamim mitichyat ha'meitim. So greater is the day of rain than the entire resurrection of the dead.
That's quite a statement.
And Meira, that's just one time I want you to queue up. That's quite a statement. All right, we're going to be able to say that a number of times tonight.
Yep.
That's exactly what...
I'll bring it in again.
Yeah, that's exactly what the other column of commentary should say. Like, whoa. Because we really are going to get a sense that the rabbis feel...
Because one is more likely than the other.
Yeah, well,
Geshem is more likely than
that could very well be part of the mix, but I doubt it.
Yeah.
What is at the core of it, though, right? Mm-hmm. Really think about this for a minute. What could lead them to say that this day of rain is greater than the resurrection of the dead? I mean, just taking that alone. Here's what the Gemara's reasoning is for it. Ve'ilu gishamim bein letzadikim bein l'rashayim. Right? That's going to be the answer. Rain benefits both righteous and wicked. De'ilu tichyat ha'metim letzadikim. But resurrection of the dead is only for the righteous. So Gemara says it backwards. De'ilu tichyat ha'metim letzadikim. Why, you ask, is the day of resurrection of the dead less than the day of rain? Because the resurrection of the dead is for the righteous, whereas rain benefits both righteous and wicked.
Why we need to support wicked?
Support what?
Why we need to support wicked? Why God cannot differentiate?
So that's the question. It's greater than in the sense of, does it, you know, let's look at the Lashon, the language. The Ilu Geshamim, Bein Letzadikim, Bein Lerashaim. So the idiomatic translation in the art scroll over here in the English is it benefits both the righteous and the wicked. What's the idiomatic Hebrew over there? Okay, Mevi'im Tova. So Mevi'im Tova is a matter of fact, right? Yeah. It's not a matter of who meitiv l'rasha'im.
Unless it's Geshem Klala.
Let's hold out on that notion, right? There can be violent rains that are terrible for the world. We know that. But in this case, we're talking about precipitation that is beneficial. But it's not as though, just based on your question, that we're saying that God is meitiv l'rasha'im. It's not that God is actually davka, doing good for rishaim. So we don't necessarily, to answer your question directly, have to support the wicked. But rain inherently benefits
everyone.
Both the good and the wicked, everyone. And if that's the answer, if that's the only answer, then we can be settled there, right? But there's other kinds of thoughts we could have about the valence if we didn't have the tzadikim and the rishaim limud. In other words, if we take out the notion that we're talking about rain being beneficial for both wicked and righteous, and we say, though, whoa, about this statement, that a day of rain is greater than the resurrection of the dead, why might we have such an assertion in the Gemara? What could it be in terms of rabbinic philosophy all about? Well, it could be about this world versus the next one. If I didn't have it just that I'm talking about the fact that rain does come down and benefit everybody, I might think that they were potentially asserting that rain in this world and the flourishing of human potential that comes with rain's providing all that's necessary by way of nutrition and all of what the world needs to create, the fuel it needs to fire on, to forge ahead. I might say that that's a better sign of God's true power. If I'm talking about the keys in the Midrash that we looked at the beginning pages, that's the quote unquote greater than key.
I can drush that.
Yeah.
I would drush it and say that if rain, the benefit, the blessing of the rain goes to everybody, including the Rashaim, it's like saying, maybe you can repent. I'll show you the goodness, and then you will admit the blessing and return.
Nice. So you're going to keep in place the notion of the tzaddikim and the rishayim having deep meaning here to provide.
Ex gadol me.
Yeah, as to provide inspiration for the rishayim to make tshuva. Nice, because that goes along with what we're going to see in the literature, where they're really asking for us to realize that rain is withheld from us because of sin.
I go for what I think you were beginning to get at, and that is the religion is really focused on this world. And so helping people today who may be starving or not being able to do other things for lack of rain is more meritorious than thinking about getting all the dead people back alive. So I think it's what we've come to view as the this worldly orientation of the religion.
Right. So this world orientation is exactly where I was, I think, sliding right into that base. And thank you for articulating it in that way that you did, because I do think that could be very well what the assertion could have been about were it not given those tzaddikim rishayim kind of reasoning. So Rabbi Abahu, Ufliga de Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef doesn't agree exactly with Rav Abahu's reasoning. And he says, the Amar of Yosef, Rav Yosef says, Mitoch shehi shekula kitchiyat ha-meitin. Since rain is equivalent to the resurrection of the dead, kivuaha b'tichiyat ha-meitin. The sages place the mention of rain, that is the liturgy that we say, vis-a-vis Morid HaGashem, that God brings the rain, b'tichiyat ha-meitin, in the blessing of tichiyat ha-meitin in the Amidah.
It's not greater, it's equivalent.
Right. Unlike Rabbi Abahu, who's really saying that Gadol Yom HaGeshamim, from this, he's saying, no, they're both equivalent, they're both keys on the ring, remember? The power of rain and the power of resurrecting the dead, and that's why they're in the same bracha. Continues. Amar Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda is going to talk about the greatness of rain now. Gadol Yom HaGeshamim Kiyom Shenitna Bo Torah.
That's the second woe.
That's the second woe. And we had this once already, remember? So now we're in the spiral curriculum. We had a hint of this, that the rain was as great, if not greater, than the day of the giving of the Torah. But now we have it again, the assertions. And woe, Shneemar, and they're going to bring a pasuk to prove it. Ya'arov kamatar likhi. My teaching shall drip down like the rain, the ein lekach ela Torah. And here the word lekach means nothing other than Torah. Shneemar, ki lekach tov natati lechem, Torah ti, al tazovu. For I have given you a good teaching, that is that lekach tov. Do not leave or abandon my teaching, my Torah. Rava says, though, in disagreement, Rava Amar, Yoter mi yom shenitna bo Torah. A day of rain is even more momentous than the day on which the Torah was given for a different reason. Shenemar, Yarov kamatar lichi, my teaching shall drip down like the rain. Now in this verse, mi nitleb mi. What's really being compared to what? Heve omer katan nitleb gadol. That a lesser thing is compared to a greater thing. Thus, rain, which serves as a metaphor for Torah, must be greater than the Torah. Rava contrasts that, though. He's going to bring an answer to that, a response. Ketiv ya'arov kamatar lichi. In the first half of the verse, it's written, my teaching shall drip down like the rain. Uchetiv tizal katal imrati. But in the second half, it's written, my speech shall flow or come down like the dew. It will, tizal is kind of like not drop down entirely and not rain down What does dew from heaven do?
Slowly.
Right.
Well, it's flow.
It's flow. And it flows from heaven, but it's not a fast flow. It's not a pouring down.
It's a slow flow.
On the one hand, Taurus compared to rain, which has a lot of force, and dew, which, here it says precipitates gently. In other words, it flows from heaven, yes, but it doesn't come pouring down. Im talmid chacham hagunhu, if a Torah scholar is of good character, katal. The Torah's effect upon him is compared to dew. It comes, it provides the necessary droplets, it moves in, it gets the right amount to him. Ve'im love, or fehu kamatar. The Torah breaks his neck like a violent rainstorm. Now, you know, we have to talk. What does that really mean? Right? How is it that we have tau that makes for good character? And matar, which is the word for precipitation, lekach, that the teaching should come down and really uproot him like a violent rainstorm. So what's the Gemara trying to teach here about sages who study Torah? If I want to say that you have good character because with Torah that comes in like the dew, and it'll break your neck like a violent rainstorm. First of all, the Gemara is trying to say Tal might be the better metaphor, right? That's what we want. That's what we desire. Just a natural flow. Slow flow. But why then, why mention that a scholar could have his neck broken by the Torah? A, it could be that it provides such a challenge to him and that his character is so out of line with what it means to be a sage that he will wind up sinning time and again, time and again, time and again, and now knowingly.
Maybe arrogance and knowledge.
Two, he will be so arrogant,
doing it wrong in the wrong way,
that he would throw Torah around and use it in the wrong way, like a violent rainstorm, like forceful balls of fire, like we read about Shimon Bar Yochai. Mm-hmm. Right? So that there's an unnaturalness to that. You're going to say something, Barry?
I'm interested in a couple of different things. I'm not sure how to deconvolute it. So we can have a Torah scholar who gets that appellation who doesn't have good character? That's my first question.
Right.
I would have assumed that anyone who meets the minimum criteria for being called a Torah scholar or by definition must be of good character, but maybe I'm missing.
Is it a Torah scholar who is a politician?
Okay.
Maybe.
So
just starting on that one.
Yeah.
I think that refreshingly and somewhat surprisingly in more, let's say, traditional reads of Gemara, the rabbis are not afraid sometimes to both say explicitly in such statements and also include stories that are displays of character that need to be refined. And they use, oftentimes, both inner, if you will, inner voices and external voices. Meaning what? The inner voice of the Gemara making a limud here, within the Midrash, to point out which assertion is right or wrong, will criticize some of the scholars who are not behaving properly. Here we just had it in its plain, kind of simple sense. Other times you'll get a story about a scholar whose behavior is being called into question by a fellow scholar. I'll give you a for instance. We studied it together. Rebbe, remember Yehuda Nasi, who's the editor of the Mishnah. In Bava Batra, when we were studying about who's responsible to build a wall around the city, and who's responsible to...
Mexicans. I couldn't do that.
Direct for it. Just remember, there's a Mishnah that calls for walls around cities. And there's also courtyards, and there's also gatehouses at the courtyards. And we talk a lot about the poor of the city. And this is like tractate tzedakah. Remember that part of Bava Batra? So Rebbe's there, and he closes the storehouses, and he won't give grain and food to the hungry people of the land. He'll only give it to the Talmidei Chachamim, to the sages who are worthy of being called sages. But here he is being analyzed by the Gemara, that's telling this story about him. And one of his students disguises himself and says, Rebbe, will you feed me? To make the long story short. Rebbe's son has to go convince his father that it's worth feeding this guy, because what are they going to say? But Rebbe still feels bad about sharing his own precious resources. And we're left a little bit puzzled that the Gemara would even criticize at worst, even raise the question at best. Was this behavior the kind of behavior we would like to see from the Chachamim, who are the chief keepers of Torah and the chief keepers also of grain? One manuscript has that grain being not only the community's grain, which we might understand he was being really super careful with, if there's long-time famine coming. And there's no proof, by the way, that that story in the Babylonian Talmud came at a time during famine. So it's more a moral story than a story about true famine in Eretz Yisrael. Doesn't appear, by the way, in the Palestinian Talmud, in the Yerushalmi. It's more critical of him if it was his grain than the community's grain. And one of the manuscripts says it was Rebbe's grain. So we are, yes, somewhat surprised. Yes, if we weren't reading to really feel out the true tension within the story of how that story challenges Rebbe when it comes to food insecurity and the respect that scholars should be granted, right? We wouldn't even see this as so difficult a story. We might say he has a job to do. He has to be very careful about who he's distributing the grain to. But internally, I don't think they're afraid to talk about the mussar, the refining of character that needs to come along with a commitment to Torah, Torah study, and Torah life. And it happens time and again and again and again. One more example of the total outside voice, because those were inside students, in very short form, Bava Kamma, Perek HaChovel, the one who injures a friend. When they bring a child to assess the damage that was done, to see how much someone owes his worker, the father of the child comes, and his voice is the one that is used by the rabbis, because we know that rabbis edited the Talmud. But the Avua de Yenuka, the father of the youth, is the one that asserts the need for justice, and that the rabbi shouldn't expose the child to too much, let's say, everything from stress to exposure in the court system that's going to determine how much money should be paid the family because of an injury. Right? Just like when a child is part of a court case and we want to protect the child from going through too much of the stress and the strenuous kind of process of seeking the justice we need, and there really was a child who was a witness, or something happened to a child, and we try to lighten that load. That's the voice of Avuah the Yenuka, because the rabbis were just willing to put the child right up there and have him weighed, measured, and assessed on the slave market as to how much he really would be worth as a laborer, and all of that. But the Avuah the Yenuka comes and says, wait a minute, are you going to handle this child the same way you would handle any other adult case? So your point is well taken, that we don't usually even read the Gemara like that, except to say that we're looking at it in a deeper way these days through the eyes of literary theory that allows us to see much more internal criticism than we would have before, and it's good to notice that here. Definitely good to notice that. Okay.
The other thing I'm interested in is metaphor, because it's such a great window into thought.
Right, you brought up the book about the metaphor.
And so this issue of all metaphors having to have something greater and something lesser, I mean, sometimes we use metaphor for equivalence. You know, it's mm-hmm. as beautiful as. So I'm not relating to this construct, and maybe it was just common in there, the way in which they thought about things. But it just struck me as being peculiar to insist that every metaphor had to have a dominant and a lesser comparator.
I think the shot answer to what you're raising is that for them this wasn't metaphor at all. Right? There's a power of making rain. There's a power of resurrecting the dead, and neither are metaphorical. And they're just trying to figure out by Yom HaHu, on that day, can I say that this day is even more glorious, greater than that day? And I don't think they meant anything metaphorically. If we were to push our read to the level of metaphor, let's say this world versus the next world, which you summed up eloquently, then you're right. The question is, why do we have a greater than or less than assertion, right? So maybe it's not really even classic metaphor. Maybe we couldn't define it like that. Maybe we have here a way of rabbinic assertion about concepts in the world that Max Kedushin would actually call value concepts, even when it seems like something physical or it would be episodic in history. The scholar Max Kedushin would say that so much even of kind of these moments, resurrection of the dead, represents a certain value conception within rabbinic parlance, and that it has a whole set of requirements. How do you actually achieve that? Being part of that, you live a life of tzedakah, you live a life of good character, you then get it. So maybe, you know, the day of rain that you also brought through your mitzvah behavior, through your righteousness, is greater than doing all the tzedakah you do for a day of rain, right? So that's the way I would think about it.
Last thing is, I can't help but think about the dry bones, you know, that our image of the dead is really a desiccated image. And so the contrasting of the rain and dry bones, you know, those two seem to match up here, you know, in terms of the importance of water. Even for the dead.
Right. And that you need a wetness to bring back death and dryness. And that's for sure, I think, part of the reason why we can insert this, and that it would speak to the ancient mindset. Because you need lach, you need water, you need moisture, you need precipitation, you need fertility. Yeah. Okay, we have more to say about Torah now. As we were saying, here's the exploration of rabbinic culture. Here's Torah, and what we're going to say on 7A1 on the right, Tanya, on the same theme of Torah. Here's a brisa. Haya Rabbi Bena'a Omer. Rabbi Bena'a used to say, Kol ha'osek b'Torah lishma, whoever studies Torah for its own sake,
For Torah's sake, not his own sake.
Well, Torah lishma is a category of activity, like in the rabbinic parlance. So lishma is you're doing the mitzvah simply for the mitzvah itself. In other words, you're not trying to find a verse to prove something. You're not trying to necessarily overcome another philosophical argument. You're not necessarily doing it because you're paid to be the reader of the Torah portion in the synagogue. You're simply sitting down to study Torah. Okay? Torah to na seitlo sam chayim. His Torah becomes a drug of life, an elixir of life to him. Sam Chaim. Shinemar, a verse proves this, Eit Chaim hi l'machazikim ba. It is a tree of life to those who hold fast to it. What does this mean now, to hold fast to it? And just this little part of the Braita means that you're studying it. Means that you're studying it. Ve'omer. And it similarly says, Rif'ut tehi l'sharecha. It will be a cure that enters
your pupik.
Your pupik, your navel. Similarly, ve'omer, Ki motzi matza chaim. For one who has found me has found life. V'chol ha'osek v'torah shelo lishma. But if you don't study Torah, for the sake of the notion that it's mitzvah to study, na'aseit lo sam hamavet, his Torah scholarship becomes a deadly poison to him. Shene'emar. Now, that means you're abusing Torah, right? You're using it to gain power. You're, what did you say before, a politician? Shene'emar, as it said, Ya'arof kamatar lichi. My teaching shall come down. Well, here it says drip, but it's not drip. It could be drip. But here it's going to come down on you pretty violently. Ve'ein arifa ela hariga. And the word arifa is nothing other than killing, right? It sounds like it, right? Because we know that arifa has to deal with at least breaking the neck, if not decapitating itself. And as it says in Devarim, Va'arfu sham et ha'egla b'nachal. Because we have a verse that says, they shall break the neck of the calf there in the riverbed. And that's the case that they find a dead body between two cities, and this one wants to say we weren't responsible, and that one wants to say we weren't responsible. And so this is a ceremonial kind of way of saying violence was committed, and we see that there's too much violence around, and we then see that the verb is used in this kind of violent way, and we understand the kind of realities that if you don't study Torah for the right sake, you really are involved in bringing violence to the world.
Where's this quote from? I don't recognize it. Where is this?
This is in Deuteronomy. Uh-huh. If you look in Perek, if I remember, it's Lamed Bet.
Kaf, Srim Vachad.
Okay.
Where's that? Let's see. Does it say?
Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Daled.
Just coming up. Wiki text. Yep.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Hold on 1 second, I'll call it up. So if one is found slain in the land which your Lord God gives you to possess, lying in the field, and it's not known who has slain him, your elders and your judges come forth, and they shall measure the distance to the cities which are around him who is slain. In other words, there's a body there, and it's not exactly known to anyone where this happened, or if it happened in a city. And it shall be that the city which is nearest to the slain man, the elders of that city shall take a heifer, which has not been worked with, and which was not pulled in by the yoke, and the elders of the city shall bring the heifer to a rough ravine, which is neither plowed nor sown, and shall strike off the heifer's neck there in the ravine, according to this translation. Getting back to the decapitation that Meira said, it's oftentimes translated as, shall break the neck thereof. And the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for them the Lord your God has chosen to minister to him, and to bless in the name of the Lord, and by their word shall every controversy and every assault be tried, and all the elders of that city which is nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer that is beheaded and in the valley, and they shall answer, our hands have not shed this blood, nor have our eyes seen it. So that's the point of this. But the bigger point is that violent act is the act, I think, that is happening by the person who's not studying Torah Lishma, and they could potentially bring violence to the world, not only through their own kind of actions in the world, but what could happen between two cities where there's no Torah? Violence will prevail. So, we had a little bit about Torah itself and Torah Lishma versus Torah Lo Lishma, which at the core of Jewish life is an essential principle that we should always be engaged in Torah Lishma. And then now they're going to go back and use some of the natural metaphors again to talk about human beings, and we're going to have this intersection of nature and humanity come in a wonderful way again. Remember, we had the blessing, how could I bless you, tree? May your offspring be like you, when the Rav asked his Rebbe for a blessing. Here, yeah, now let's kind of spiral back that way. A person, this is good for the time, right? We're in Shvat. Tu B'Shvat is almost coming. So this is a perfect place to be in the Gemara for the new year of the trees. Amar le Rabbi Yirmiyahu, Rabbi Zera. Rabbi Yirmiyahu asked Rabbi Zera, Leite mar leitne, could the master come and teach something halachic, some kind of law? Amar le, Rabbi Zera answered him, Halash levai velo yachilna, I feel faint. I'm unable to teach. Again, what is that, right? We could ask in and of itself. Like, what kind of phrase is that for a sage whom we think should jump at any moment, any moment's notice to teach and would want to teach, especially a fellow chacham, a fellow sage? Lema mar milta de agarita. Rabbi Yirmiyah then asked, okay, if you're not going to teach me a discourse about some particular of the law, how about teaching some agadic thought? How about an agada?
There's some stories.
So one might see here the quote-unquote ranking of certain kinds of rabbinic teachings in terms of the energy needed to expend upon them, right? Or even a kind of hierarchy of limud, which some actually do hold as a very serious contention, that if I ask you for a halachic discourse, mar litnich, he says, lite mar litne, come teach really a true kind of mishneiic halachic teaching, and he can't do it. This gives rise to the fact that, okay, that takes much more thought, much more energy, much more decisive sage action than what? Than the agada that he asks for when he says, I'm too tired. So we all know that there's something, though, about agadic literature that has to be respected in a kind of different way, and that is not always so hierarchical. That from agadic literature also comes very serious learning. Like the example I gave when Barry noticed that the rabbis were being self-critical. On the one hand, I could say in a quippy sentence, here's a sage who doesn't have such great midot, doesn't have such great qualities. He's like a violent rainstorm. On the other hand, it could say about Rebbe Yehuda, who's the editor of the Mishnah, whom we respect greatly, that through the Agadita, through the tale we tell about his distribution of food in Bava Batra, and the student that comes, and the ultimate workout of his generosity versus his closed-mindedness about who really deserves the food they've got in the soup kitchen, in the storehouses, I should say. It's not a soup kitchen, to be exact. That agadita has great powerful meaning. Right? It's like, again, in the philosophical zone of law, Robert Cover suggesting that I've got codes, I've got apodictic law, but I also have narrative. And law can be derived from narrative, or it could be exemplars of the kind of law that holds in a society. And so I always have to balance between the narrative, the story, and the law. Is it easier ultimately to tell a story than it is to make a halachic kind of discourse?
Probably.
I don't know. Some people really have legal minds. Some people have more story minds. So even though it seems like sometimes we do get this hierarchical ranking of, you know, those who learn Talmud inside all the laws and the legal discourses and the Mishneh kind of thinking versus those who are masters of Agada and or like to study Haggadah and the stories of the Talmud, there's more to it than just these are stories and that's the real learning. However,
and that learning from Haggadah, from the story, is learning through the heart, while learning from the discourse is learning from the in the mind through the mind.
That's an interesting way to say it too. It's like the rational mind and the emotional quotient.
Exactly.
Yes, maybe
it brings it to life. Get it? You don't even know that you're learning, but you're learning.
Yes, sometimes.
Yeah, I think you're also. It's like case law. You're perhaps seeing things that you didn't articulate in the written law. That there's some underlying thing there that's being revealed.
Mm.
Some principles that haven't been articulated, so
right.
You can extract out of that, maybe later become law. But
yeah, and not all of them are about law. You know, admittedly.
Yeah.
Right. However, they might relate to the law. Mm-hmm. Right, and something could come out as you're suggesting. Definitely. Like, there is going to be a law that's going to be quoted right now, even though it's going to be seemingly a thought about human beings on a more philosophical level. So, Rabbi Zera answers him. Now he's ready to go. Amar Hachi Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan taught the following. My dichtiv, what's the meaning of that which is written? Ki ha'adam eitz hasadeh. For a man is a tree of the field, or a man is a tree of the field. It all depends on how you kind of intone this part of the pasuk, if you want to get the real sense of what's going on in that part of the Torah. V'chi adam eitz sadehu. Now, is a man a tree of the field? Ele mishum dichti. Rather, this verse compares a man to a tree with regard to what's written concerning a fruit-bearing tree. For you eat from it, and you may not cut it down. And with a non-fruit-bearing tree, it says, you shall destroy it and cut it down. How so? In the case of a Torah scholar who is of proper character, you shall eat from him, meaning study from him, learn from him, and not cut him down. Ve'im lov, but if he's not such a nice guy, if he doesn't have such great midot, if he's not able to teach, if he's just thrusting Torah at you like a violent rainstorm, oto tashchit v'charat, you shall destroy him and cut him down. Meaning what?
So you're reading,
you shun him.
So it's a question of what word do you emphasize? Is he a man is a tree of the field, or a man is a tree of the field? One is very common and not worth anything, but if it's a tree of the field, maybe.
Yeah, but even a tree that is not a man, so to speak, gives shade. And when they used to travel by foot, they need trees with no fruit to have shade. So I don't know why to cut them off.
Okay.
Especially when you go from Jerusalem to Babel.
I mean, that's a practical response to I have a problem with the whole Haggadah.
Right, yeah.
And with the law of the Torah. So that's, again,
that
like we just said before.
Only fruit trees are worthwhile.
Right.
On a hot day.
Right.
Right. It's not a good thing about a hot day. Not a good thing about a hot day, right. But here they're talking about when you wage war, remember. The context of those passages when you wage war.
Yes.
And you need to use some of the trees to make either weapons, or you're looking to lay siege. At least you shouldn't cut down the fruit-bearing trees. But it's this interesting question about trees and human beings, and it brings it out again. And it reminded me of a couple of outside readings today, or a couple of outside references. This is a collection, the JPS Scholar of Distinction series was published. Jacob Pitkowski was a great scholar of Hebrew Union College, of the Reform Movement, and just talking about scholars and trees, remember we had the blessing before, how shall I bless you? Your leaves are so beautiful, your fruit's so beautiful, this offspring may be like you, and over here, a person can be like the tree of the field and give fine fruits, and we should learn from him. Just this, this, you know, intertextual connection here, just about trees and other things that the rabbis say about trees and sages. So the article is called "The Rabbi and the Tree," talking about Mishnah Avot 3:7. He who walks on the way and studies and interrupts his Mishnah, his study, and says, "How beautiful is this tree?" Scripture reckons it to him as if he had forfeited his life. This Mishnah has given rise to many explanations. Not only is it remarkable that a spontaneous admiration of nature is so ruthlessly condemned here, but there's an additional problem that the rabbinic tradition itself calls for a benediction to be recited on such occasions, a benediction in which God is praised for the beauty of nature. This apparent contradiction did not escape the commentators. It's mentioned by Ovadia Bordonero, Samuel de Usida, Rabbi Travers Hereford, and Joseph H. Hertz. Those commentators assume that the author of this Mishnah must have been fully aware of this contradiction. Obviously, he must have had good reasons for maintaining the negative view, despite the contradictions. What were those reasons? In general, the traditional commentators speak of the danger connected with any journey. And that means particularly the danger of being attacked by Satan. But the study of Torah is tried and the proved antidote to the Satan, to all evil forces against us. This is why the traveler is pictured as studying on the way to begin with. The exceptional case. And Ron just brought up the case of people traveling and needing shade. So, other connections. But the moment he interrupts his study, he is surrendering to Satan. That is, it is as if he had forfeited his life. Thus Rashi in the Maaser Vitri, Samuel de Osita, Yom Tov Lipman Heller in Israel, Luke Sheets. It's interesting that Maimonides in his Mishnah commentary has nothing to say about our Mishnah at all. It is to be doubted whether he would have regarded the study of Torah as a protection against the demonic forces. At any rate, his disciple, Yosef ben Yehuda ibn Aknin, interprets our Mishnah in the sense of there being only two legitimate topics of conversation. One either speaks about the Torah, which gives life to the soul, or one talks about practical things connected with making a living. But the man described in our Mishnah does neither. Instead, he is speaking of useless things, and therefore forfeits his life. Ovadia Bardnaro, too, regards the quoted admiration of nature as a useless It's a useless conversation in Sicha B'Tela, in his looking at the mitzvah of how one has to have important sichot versus conversations that have no place. It may thus be seen that every age has tended to apply this Mishnah to its own world of thought. But can we determine what the author of the Mishnah himself meant to say? And he goes forward and says that based on some of his look at manuscripts and some of his look at scholars, imagine a student in the process of committing material to his memory by the method of repetition. He interrupts the repetition in order to say, "How beautiful is this tree?" This immediately creates the likelihood that the words, "How beautiful is this tree?" will henceforth become part and parcel of the material to be repeated. An authentic tradition will thereby be destroyed. For the student, this would mean that he has forfeited his life in the same way that following Mishnah and Avot declares him to be forfeiting his life who consciously tries to forget a component of the material to be repeated as a loyal sage. So that insertions like this are what's the issue in terms of how he then wraps up his commentary. And he's forfeiting not only his life, but he's forfeiting the life of the learning that came before him because it's now mishubash. It's now corrupted. The parallel is when scribes will be describing something, and sometimes they'll double a word because they think, or they didn't even realize they had already written one, and then they double it. Or, this happens often to those who know certain prayers by heart, or you start to hear a couple of words, right? Baruch atah. And you think you know what the next word is that's supposed to be said is, right? But there's a couple of verses that start Baruch atah, but don't have then Adonai after them. There are other words there, right? But you put in Adonai, and it becomes a tradition that the verse you have now has Baruch atah Adonai, because you're so used to saying blessings, Baruch atah Adonai Elohim Melech HaOlam. But really the verse, in several places where Baruch atah comes together, doesn't get an Adonai, right? And so it becomes a written tradition that's now got an extra word inserted, or you said it out loud when you were teaching, even, and you didn't even realize you said it, because your brain worked just like that. So that's the point of the Mishnah, which redeems it from being anti-nature, at least, right? Which is good in my book. So Rabbi Dr. Pitkowski really helps me redeem that Mishnah, because I think here there's such a deep respect for nature in our Gemara, despite the fact that sometimes it can pour down, be a violent rainstorm if you're too much, if you're not enough of a mensch, or you don't take your Torah and use it in the best way.
So he's really saying it's not about nature per se; it's about succumbing to a distraction while you're doing something.
Exactly, and even inserting it, and then a tradition being born of that by saying it. Careful what you articulate.
Right.
Careful what you write down. Right?
No multitasking.
Very interesting. Right. Well, you be careful about your multitasking, which, you know, despite how gendered it may sound, especially young man, keep your head on straight.
So Satan is lurking all the time. The entrance.
Oh, especially in these days.
I'm saying during that commentary period.
And during the Gemara period. Demonic forces definitely exist. Like, we were familiar with those in Pesachim. We looked at only one of three or four pages
right.
that dealt with.
Even though there's no Satan in the Torah.
Well, there's Satan in the book of Job.
Right, but not
in the Torah.
Not in the Torah itself. But there is Satan, who's this demonic force, this arch, you know, angelic force against God.
Sick.
The challenger.
The story of the Pardes, that the one got in and they see God and Satan sitting on near each other. So
it's definitely an alive reality.
Yeah, but isn't Satan portrayed more as the accuser? It's frequently translated as.
It's often translated as accuser. I would say it's the challenger. More than
it's
the
not
accuser.
So much challenging God as it is
prosecuting.
I think that Satan is like a prosecuting attorney for the sins, or the too simplistic of faith, or the general acceptance in the world of God.
Opposite
and that makes it more than just a prosecutor against one individual. The accuser or the challenger or the angel who works to destroy godliness is the way that I would see it in a bigger exploration of the theme of Satan in the book of Job. And thusly, in the book of Sefer HaYashar, which is a medieval midrashic work that brings that character into the Akedah, who is challenging Abraham, who is challenging the world around Abraham in terms of acceptance of God and what God commands.
But at that point, aren't you getting a lot of Christian influence?
Well, it definitely Sefer Yeshar you are.
Yeah.
But moving backwards into the Gemara period and into Eov, I think that you do get a sense that there is a direct challenge to God's omnipotent authority. We could read it inside one time and take a look. Maybe that's a good theme to have a couple of classes about during a summer. Satan and demons.
I think there is a point here because there is a verb from Satan, a verb, lastin, the mastinim are the people, mastinim, people who come and say bad things, like a blood libel and things like that. These are mastinim. It is accusation, but very bad results.
Libelous accusation.
Like libel, very...
libelous.
So there's a point there about the accusation. I never thought about it until you...
Yeah.
And then it came to me.
Yeah. I think it's multifaceted is the point.
Hmm?
I think that it's more multifaceted than we often just have in terms of one translator,
exactly.
One translation.
That's what I get out of that verb.
And the point is that it's very much alive for folks in the Gemara period.
Every second of the day.
Yeah, you're constantly fighting against this. Constantly watching how you're walking. For those for whom it really was a pronounced consciousness, you walked in certain constellations to avoid demonic forces. You for sure didn't walk underneath certain kinds of trees to bring the trees in, according to Masechet Pesachim. You were careful about all these things.
Babylonia.
Yeah.
And you're into Zoroastrianism
and evil forces in the world.
Evil forces, yeah, that influences.
Yeah. And our evil forces are not dualistic evil forces. They're definitely forces in geology and demonology that exist within the Jewish system that has at its core only one God, and only one God who has all the power to overcome it and allows for it to happen in the world in some way. Just like Kabbalah will posit later on down the line that there's space in the world still for chaos and evil, so that there can be more and more and more redemption, measures of security, measures of godly protection. Yeah, different topic, but interesting topic. Different topic, but interesting. Let's push on a little bit with some more of this Gemara. The Gemara wants to bring a series of teachings about the advantages of studying Torah together with others now. Okay? And part of that is to bring out the best in each other. Because we saw here in these that you could have sages whose character is called into question. So we want to bring out the best. So Amar Rabbi Chama, Amar Rabbi Chanina. My dichtiv, what's the meaning of that which is written? Barzel Bivarzel Yachad. Iron sharpens iron. In other words, that one man sharpens another. Lo marlecha, ma barzel zeh, teaches you the justice. In the case of this iron blade, echad mechaded et chavero. The one blade sharpens another. Af shnei talmidei chachamim. So too with the Torah scholars. Mechadedin zeh et zeh bahalacha. They sharpen each other's minds with their debates about halacha. So there's a question that I was once asked by a teacher who brought this small passage to us when we were getting set to become teachers, and that is, why would you want to use such metaphors of iron sharpening iron? You know, what other metaphors could exist that talk about coming up with halachic debates and solutions? You know, something a little bit more gentle, perhaps, than clang, clang, clang.
Yeah, especially since iron instruments are not even allowed if you're going to make a pillar for sacrifice.
Yeah.
They're not allowed to use.
Right. Isn't it just a fascinating harnessing of what's being used out there?
But I think it's... My sense is that it's warlike because the two interacting are really engaged in thrust and parry. That is certainly a martial image could easily be superimposed on that kind of
interaction. Right. I think that image of such passionate parry. What is it called? A parry and
thrust, lunge,
right, all these kind of metaphors from fencing, the fencing world, the world of battle, that the rabbis are recognizing that sometimes is what it seems like. But what will come out of that is a better world.
It's funny, I read it completely without that metaphor. And I mean without that picture in my mind.
And what picture was the one in yours?
Sharpening a knife. We have, it's better to have one metal that's harder than the other metal, than the metal of the knife. That's why you have a sharpening steel against a carbon knife. But in a pinch, you can take two knives and sharpen one like a chef would, one against the other, exactly as it says here. So I easily pictured that they were literally sharpening two implements by sharpening one against the other. You can't sharpen a knife that way.
Nice. Very nice. Yeah. And there's a certain elegance to that, by the way, right?
Yeah.
Just aesthetically?
Yeah.
And a certain master craftsmanship in that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
nice. Quality. One sharpen, they dance against each other, you're equal power, but just by interacting, you get sharpened. It's an evenness there.
Yeah.
Bazel.
Right. Good, and there's an evenness. So here you have scholars who are, if you will, even, and one's not any better than the other.
Isn't it a combination of both? Because
I still see it as both. I for sure read it.
Exactly, because even though it may seem like a war going on and fire, there's an elegance that it's all about some sort of a level that they're trying to achieve, some clarity to any situation. As a chef would when he does a knife and tries to create an image. But I think it's more like both of them together.
Yeah, I see them both together, not one overcoming the other.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, evenness.
Well, it's especially when you consider how much they fought against each other.
Yeah.
It sometimes got very violent.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, Brazil with Brazil.
No doubt. So, on the same, continuing on, Amar Rabba Barbar Hana, Lemanim Shalu Divrei Torah Ka'esh. Why are the words of Torah compared to fire? Now again, immediately when they say the words of Torah compared to fire, we may all have very different images come into our minds.
It comes after the Barzel, it's like
So, after the Barzel, doesn't it seem like a furnace?
Is in the furnace.
Couldn't it appear like candles being lit for Yontif? Couldn't it be like a blaze happening somewhere that it's not supposed to happen? Couldn't it be like a campfire? There's all kinds of images that could come flowing in when we say fire. Again, in terms of metaphor, for sure fire is grounded. It's an experience all people were very close to fire in the ancient world. They knew about fire, and in all kinds of different stoves, but they knew of open fires. So the words of Torah are compared to fire. Shneemar, halo cho divari ka'esh ne'um Hashem. Is my word not like fire, says God? Lomar lecha, this is to teach you. Ma eish eino dolek yechidi, just as fire does not ignite from a single piece of wood. Af divrei Torah ein mitkayamin bi yechidi. So too the words of Torah are not retained by someone who studies on his own. You need a partner to light the flames together. V'hainu de'amar Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, and this is the essence of what Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina said, Mai dichtiv cherev el abadim v'no'alu, a sword upon those who are alone, and they shall become fools. Cherev al son'ehen shel tamidei chachamim. It's interpreted as sword upon the enemies of such Torah scholars. Torah scholars here again we have all these kind of influence of battle coming in focus. Maybe that's why I'm influenced by the iron above as well. V'lo od ela she mitapshin, and not only that, but they become foolish as well. Shenemar v'noalu, as it said in the verse, they shall become fools. V'lo od ela she chotin, and not only that, but they're going to sin. Ketiv hacha v'noalu, but here it's written concerning those who study alone, they shall become fools. Ketiv hatam, elsewhere it's written asher noalnu v'asher chatanu, that we have acted foolishly in that which we have sinned. So I'm proving that together, learning b'chevruta, learning will provide the kind of iron and iron sharpening one another, the kind of fire that is hearth fire, that is oven baking fire, that is provision for warmth fire, right? But if I do this alone, then, you know, it stays alone. It's not only potentially useless, it's a fire that doesn't really warm, it doesn't really cook, it doesn't really generate the kind of positive image of fire that we want here. You can become a fool, is the message. But you need to become people who are, quote-unquote, around the fire. This led me to think about a book that I have that I like very much. It's not exactly on the role of fire in the Jewish tradition, but I want to commend it to you. It's a really interesting book called Keepers of the Flame, and it's about the role of fire in American culture. And it's just a lovely book that goes from, if you will, it really goes from colonial times to the 20th century, early 20th century, to talk about how we harnessed the power of fire in very different ways in modernity. And that, in and of itself, allowed for us to generate a world, right? The kind of hope that a metaphor like this one in the Gemara really is put into place for is to say, we need Torah for the world. We need to light the fires of holiness, of goodness, of definitely perpetuating rabbinic culture. But realistically, fire in and of itself helps us make progress, in a sense, in ways that we just never would be able to without the kind of gift it is to, whether it's the world of the next small invention or the way we cook something or the way we create factory and light the fires and the furnaces that are necessary for the mass production, that was in a certain way part of the great hope that we're really seeing some of the hopes of, let's say, the philosophers of freedom. I'll just call them that, the philosophers of the hope that we would move into an age when more and more people could be taken care of with the limited resources we have on Earth. Right? That fire was an essential component of that, harnessing fire. But what's fun about this book is that it starts back and it says on page 4 of the book, nevertheless, it was fire, that mystical, magical tool of antiquity that energized the majority of domestic and commercial activities during the colonial period, and that by the 19th century had become a leitmotif of the country's life. For lo, we live in an iron age, in the age of steam and fire. So there's our iron and our fire all together in the statement. Wrote a poet who was mesmerized by the fire-powered steam engines that by the 1850s had begun to revolutionize American transportation, agriculture, and industry. Other types of fires animated diverse sectors of society simultaneously. Gas fires glowed in the cities, camp fires dotted the prairie, the blacksmith's coals burned brightly in almost every settlement between. Counterbalancing these restless flames of progress, meanwhile, were legions of home fires that via the fireplace, stove, candle, and lamp provided the necessary energy to run individual households and nurture domestic life. Americans of the 19th century liked to measure their national progress according to a variety of standards. Tons of iron and steel produced, miles of railroad tracks laid, and even the number of brass bands discoursing sweet music. At the foundation of it all, however, lay the proven ability of the population at large to build and manipulate fires. And I think, you know, that's why they want to harness this metaphor. There's an understanding of that already in antiquity.
That just gives the positive side of fires. And,
yeah.
And, I mean, I think about in colonial times that women's dresses would catch on fire and that they were cooking in front of open stoves, not stoves, fireplaces, that must have been incredibly hot. And then you get to the Chicago fire and cities burning down. And it's like, there's another side.
So page 9, to pick up on your point. I wasn't going to read it, but now that you mention it, I will, because it's so true.
Well, but in this context,
right.
Torah, I mean, it's like, don't teach certain things to certain people. Torah is something very positive, but also very powerful and can be negative. It can
like
have the wrong...
Like all technology. So one thing from an evolutionary standpoint that they point to is our face. You know, we don't have the same muscles of mastication, but some primates have to spend 12 hours a day chewing. And it was really fire that allowed us to be able to get nutrients much more efficiently with much less mastication. Mm. So our whole physiognomy was really totally dependent upon
cooked food.
Understanding how to cook food.
Mm. We're perfectly evolved to eat roasted red meat.
Yeah, well, we won't get to the... I'm happy to discuss the downside. the
downside comes after.
But even the roots, vegetables and things, you know, that would take you all day to chew if you couldn't put them in a stew. So that's really one of the things that the evolutionary biologists talk about.
So just to restate what you said, the change in the muscular reality.
If you take a look at our primate colleagues, mm-hmm. their muscles of mastication are much, much more developed. That's why their faces are so broad.
So big, though.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they have the face they have.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to wind up with much narrower faces, with much less commitment of actually energy to mastication. It, you know, it takes a lot of energy. So all of this was really connected, really to two things. One was fire and the ability to cook food so that it could be taken in easier. The other was getting a longer and longer bowel.
The woman was claiming that they're developing
our brain.
Our
brains couldn't get this big and be so energy costly without getting more calories in.
Mm.
And among the ways were learning how to cook and having very long digestive systems to have better capture of the nutrients going through.
Fascinating. Fascinating. So back to that harnessing point. Fire was such a constant essential concern for most people that it functioned as the man-made counterpart of nature's sun, says the author. The day started and ended at the hearth, and much of the work of the intervening hours revolved around the open flame. On one level, fire maintenance constituted nothing more than a fairly routine, if profoundly time-consuming chore. Starting a fire could, under ideal circumstances, be amazingly simple. Fires could be built almost anywhere with a bewildering variety of fuels. Both portable and, if properly banked, preservable fire permitted its users great freedom of mobility, as well as limited laxity in technique. One could always borrow a coal from a neighbor. With the introduction of friction matches after 1827, it became possible to start fires almost instantly, whenever and wherever needed. At the same time, however, fire maintenance was a deadly serious business. Even the slightest lapse in caution could precipitate the disastrous transformation of fire from friendly ally to ravaging destroyer. The experience of Mrs. Orosimus Boyd, an army wife stationed in the remote area of Nevada during the late 1860s, illustrates the problem in stark detail. Home for the Boyds consisted of the basics, two tents, a bed, and because winters were brutal, several heating devices. Specifically, a large stove had been placed in the outer tent and a huge fireplace built in the inner one. A large pine bunk forming a double bed occupied nearly all the spare space and left only just enough room in front of the fire to seat oneself and also to accommodate the tiniest shelf for toilet purposes. In such cramped quarters, as Mrs. Boyd explained, it was only a matter of time before fire the benefactor became fire the destroyer. In our inability to find suitable places for necessary articles, we were apt to use most inappropriate ones. On the occasion referred to, a lighted candle had been placed on the bed, where my husband seated himself without noticing the candle. Soon arose the accustomed smell of burning, and I executed my usual maneuver of turning about in front of the fire to see if my draperies had caught. The odor of burning continued to increase, yet I could find no occasion for it. The cause, however, was discovered when I leaned over the bed and saw that a large hole had been burned in the center of Mr. Boyd's only uniform coat. He had been too intent on shielding me to be conscious of his own peril. It was an accident much to be regretted, for our isolation was so complete that any loss, however trifling, seemed irreparable by reason of our remoteness from supplies. Yeah. So here you have this narrative, and just points out in Roughing It, for example, Mark Twain satirizes the agonizing process of coaxing a reluctant fire to life, ruthlessly exposing the shortcomings of such ignition devices as pistols, rubbing two sticks together, and of course matches, which though lovable and precious and sacredly beautiful to the eye, are in this case entirely ineffective. Yeah. So they would try to get it right. Back to the notion that it's so simple to come up with. Burning, yet sometimes fires were started and you immediately lost control, and all kinds of responses and systems for responses had to be created, and you know, so was born early in the country's history bucket brigades, and then all kinds of responses to these realities of fire, both locally, hyper-locally, and as you mentioned, cities. And that's for real as well. So yes, there's a little bit of balance throughout the book,
yeah,
about both the upside and the destructive side.
Just two other tidbits. One is deforestation, which occurred to feed those perpetual fires. The other is the impact on cooking. So where fuel for fire was very limited in those cultures, they cut everything into tiny pieces so that they could cook it very fast, whereas those that had plenty of logs could do something on a spit for hours. So really the availability of fuel related to the fire dramatically affected the way in which people learned how to cook.
Is there a volume about that you're remembering that you read?
No, but a bunch of different things.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Together.
I just, you know, since we're recommending books. So this is an interesting read just in terms of fire in our nation, but also the whole metaphor and how to deepen the connectivity with this metaphor of fire and the potential of the fire of Torah doing its work in the world. Turn to 783 on the left side. We'll get back to nature. Look at the left-hand side where Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak is teaching. Amar Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, lema nimshalu divrei Torah ke'etz. Why are the words of Torah compared to a tree? Shneemar, etz chayim hi lemachazikim ba. The Torah is a tree of life for those who cling to it. Lomar lecha, that is to teach you, ma etz katan madlik et hagadol. Just as a small piece of wood, again going back to the fire in here, just as a small little piece of kindling ignites the large one. Af talmidei chachamim, so too is it with Torah scholars. Kitanim mechadadin et hagedolim, the younger ones sharpen the minds of the older ones with their constant questioning. You know, they are kindling to the great sages. V'hainu de'amar Rabbi Hanina, and this is in essence what Rabbi Hanina said, harbe lamadati mi rabotai, I have learned much from my teachers, ume chaverai yoter mi rabotai, and from my colleagues more than from my teachers, umi talmidai yoter mi kulan, but from my students I have learned more than all of them.
Yeah,
mitalmidai iskalti. And that is said in a different Mishnah, by the way. That's a parallel Mishnah in Avo. Over here, we have this lesson. I learned a lot from my teachers, more from my colleagues, most from my students. I just heard this quoted, this very Gemara, on Sunday night. I went to the Ramaz annual dinner, and like a TED talk, this young man wore one of these microphones over here, and he had slides behind him, and the idea was 10 minutes of this very engaging talk about his organization that he developed called Kol HaNe'arim. And more inspiration you wouldn't imagine. The short form is that Ramaz has this woman who's always organized chesed. And they've done wonderful programs and projects throughout the years, and one of them was to help students find a couple of week visits during the summer if they wanted to, instead of camp, go do something good and kind. So she found a place for this young man to go who was going to spend a couple of weeks in a camp for children who came from broken families, parents who were in jail, drug addictions and the like, in poverty, what have you, all kinds of situations. So he spent the time, and he said this was really moving and powerful. He went back to yeshiva for a year after high school, before college, convinced he was going to be a doctor, because that's what he thought the world of goodness and kindness should mean. Not only does he think about medicine, he starts thinking about how do I really do kindness in bigger and larger, immediate ways for children, since he had that experience with the children. And it can't be through becoming a pediatrician at the moment. What am I going to do? He said with his friend, they raised lots of money for one of these camps, like the one he had served in. But then he said, you know, we should get a group of students together and start our own. So he and a friend devised this plan that in Israel, they're going to start a special camp. And they're going to give the opportunity to either high school seniors or those who are coming on a gap year to start the first camp, Kol HaNe'arim, the voice of the children. And it's also, when you say it out loud, it could mean all the children, right? And it's also about the voice of the children. And amazingly, he says, I don't know how they trusted us. Here we were, two high schoolers ourselves, practically. 35 kids came to Israel that summer to start their very first camp. 11 years later, there is an enormous amount of thousands of children and volunteers and mega dollars from the financial world in New York thrust behind this effort to have camp experiences in Israel, which weren't like Muvan Me'alav, wasn't assumed like summer camp we have here in America. Right? This is kind of a new thing to have these camps that now work with these children, and not only that, but for all the kids who have gone through the system and who go into the army and literally have not a single family member behind them or with them, they assign a volunteer who goes to the Tekes HaGiyus when they get drafted into the army and when they need a place to come home and the like. And the enormity of the project, I can't begin to describe in what is a decade of work. And this woman presented the award to this young man who wound up not going into medicine, but went into finance because he realized that he didn't have enough money to run the organization without making the connections in the world of the financial sector. And has done everything, navigating all the lines of his life, to try to really bring this kindness and this chesed into the world and this organization to life. And he's so succeeded, and the woman quoted this Gemara in front of the crowd. And I had learned this for our class, and I said, you know, you can't buy these kinds of examples. I couldn't find these kinds. I couldn't make a Hollywood script that was any better. You know, the Gemara came to life in a way that's really true. That one scholar, if you say that all the teachers there were really scholars in a sense, really were responding to their students, and the students then taught the teachers what it means. You know, when they created this small opportunities, he just took it and ran. Really amazing. Really amazing. I'll get you the name of... The official name of the organization is Kol HaNa'arim. But I don't remember now who the principal guy was. I remember his face, and I remember his story. But I'll call up his name at some point. So, the metaphors will continue to be expanded, if you will, or there will be other grounded metaphors, not just the fire, not just the tree. Now we're going to go and compare it to water. Rabbi Hanina bar Papa says, wait a minute, let me bring these verses. Ketiv likrat tzamei heitayu mayim. Bring water to the thirsty. A teacher should go to the student to teach him Torah. Uchetiv, but in another verse it says, hoi kol tzamei lechulamayim. But everyone that's thirsty should go to the water. So here we have the teachers that have to go out, and here we have that the students need to come. Im talmid hagun hu, if the students of proper character, likrat samehe tayu mayim, bring water to the thirsty. But if not, what? If he's not really of great midot, he's not really of proper character, hoi kol tzame lechula mayim, everyone that's thirsty, go to the water. Student has to go to the teacher. And so there we are again with the notion that students should be a little bit... lacking proper character. And in that vein, for ending tonight, I'll bring you one other literary piece that it reminded me of. And maybe some of you have read Chaim Grad, the great Yiddish writer who died in the 1980s here in the Bronx, lost his whole family to the Holocaust, and his wife finally translated his Yiddish work into English. You know, he wasn't so keen on his second wife, that's true.
He lost his first.
Yeah, he lost his first. And there's a page in the yeshiva, parts one and two were published together, that this kind of notion of can we see that the rabbis are self-critical, as Barry, you said before, or can we see that they're really, really trying to express the notion that everybody's working on himself. Everybody's got to improve his character, right? Because that's what really we're saying. We're not saying maybe that there's even a bad apple and there's a good apple. Everybody's got to constantly be working on being the best he can be, right? And I say he advisedly at this point to say that it, generally was a world of men. But this is from page 202. My teachers and colleagues, the old man of Nevarduk, Reb Yosef Yisrael Hurwitz, always said that the worst sentence for a person is to be unable to renounce his own nature. But if a person tries hard to overcome his innate evil traits, heaven comes to his aid. So let us ask for heavenly help in the words of the prayer, our Father, Avinu, our King, Malkenu, destroy the evil decree against us. The Rosh Yeshiva cried out and would cry these words, and they would be repeated by the entire congregation like thunder, reverberating on a mountain where every abyss, ravine, and slope echoed the sounds a hundredfold. My teachers and colleagues, Reb Simcha's voice was heard again, and the other voices began to recede and vanish as crumbling thunder dwindles into the distance. We believe with perfect faith that the world is sustained by virtue of the saintly soul. And we want to be saints. But at first glance, some of us might think, is it possible? I slave away to achieve perfection. I walk about disheveled and hungry, and the world that is sustained through me even makes fun of my ritual fringes. But whoever thinks thus is surely not one of the saints, because of whom the world is sustained. The Talmud tells us about the sage Rabbi Hananya ben Dosa, who said, every day a heavenly voice is heard, saying, the entire world is sustained because of my son Hananya, yet one measure of carobs suffices Hananya from one Sabbath eve to the next. The true man of perfection is satisfied with a pot of dried carob from one Sabbath eve to the next. He demands nothing and even lovingly accepts the humiliation of the world which is sustained on account of him. And so, my dear friends, with the strength of a vast multitude, let us come at least one step closer to the presence of Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa. Now, in this hour of mercy, with the heavenly gate open, we repent. We look to refine our souls. We look to become the saintly. With our teeth clenched, Zundel Kottennapper hummed along, his razor-sharp voice seemingly flaying strips of his own skin. His humming fused with Yankel Pulsifer's cries of ay-ay-ay. Pulsifer was shouting as if he despaired of repentance for his sins. A young scholar aimed his childish whining heavenward, pleading like a fledgling in first flight, who has just managed to reach the nearest tree, but can't grasp a twig with its claws.
Is this a novel?
Yeah. This is an incredible novel. Highly recommend. Highly recommend. But there's all our metaphors all in one. And that image of the Talmid, of the student, of the youngest one, like a small bird who can't flap the wings, who can't get to that little twig. You know, there's that tree of life that he's holding on to. It's the worry we can never be the kind of rabbis, the sages, the holders of the world that we need to be. It's everything that's coming through all these different human beings, one after the next. And that's another piece I just want to emphasize as we get up from our learning tonight. This is about, in general terms, what Torah is. It's about the individuals who hold Torah and learn Torah and bring Jewish values into the world. To be continued.
Thank you.